This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you. Hello and welcome to Navarra Live. I'm Moya Lothie McLean, and tonight I'm joined by Helena, aka No Justice MTG, on YouTube and Twitch.
Good to be back as always. Lovely to spend the evening with you and looking forward to the show.
You've been playing a lot of shifts lately. We need to make you a full host. Coming up later tonight, the latest Israeli plan for the Palestinians who have fled to Rafah, and Diane Abbott makes herself heard after the Commons Speaker failed to give her the opportunity to do so yesterday. Let's go to our first story. Community Secretary Michael Gove has announced the government's new redefinition of extremism. It will be used by ministers to decide whether groups and organisations should be classed as extremist. That classification is not statutory, aka it's not legislation, but it would bar those groups from accessing government funds and stop them from meeting with government officials or civil servants, aka being able to engage with top policymakers. Gove set out the reasons for the new definition in the House of Commons.
In order to protect our democratic values and enhance social cohesion, it is important both to reinforce what we all have in common and to be clear and precise in identifying the dangers posed by extremism. As our new definition makes clear, extremism can lead to the radicalization of individuals, deny people their full rights and opportunities, suppress freedom of expression, incite hatred, weaken social cohesion, and ultimately, it can lead to acts of terrorism. Most extremist materials and activities are not illegal and do not meet a terrorism or national security threshold. For example, Islamist and neo-Nazi groups in Britain are operating lawfully, but they advocate and work towards the replacement of democracy with an Islamist or Nazi society. The Department for Leveling Up Housing and Communities has been working with local authorities, civil society and faith groups, especially in those areas where social cohesion is most under strain, to de-escalate tensions and to explore the most constructive support that we can offer. From our engagement, we hear widespread unease over the safety and security of community organizations, political candidates, and elected officials. Councillors have been threatened with violence. Council meetings have been disrupted. Council officers and elected members talk of walking a tightrope, terrified of inadvertently saying the wrong thing, of offending one side or another. Many choose to remain silent, to take no action. Mr. Speaker, such is the chilling effect of these extremist groups on our democracy.
Very ironic. That's an interesting slide that Gove makes there. He begins by talking about neo-Nazi and Islamist groups, groups that may actually hold quite extreme beliefs. But he ends up talking about disruptions to council meetings, which he blames on extremist groups. That's how easy the Tories find it to put groups who hold extreme beliefs under the same umbrella as protesters who are simply using democratic forums to hold officials to account. And the government's new definition makes it easier than ever to blur the line between potentially dangerous extremism and disruptive action. This is from the government's briefing on the new guidance. Extremism is the promotion or advancement of an ideology based on violence, hatred, or intolerance that aims to negate or destroy the fundamental rights and freedoms, or undermine, overturn, or replace the UK's system of liberal parliamentary democracy and democratic rights, or intentionally create a permissive environment for others to achieve the results in one or two. Just draw attention to that third criterion. There seems to be several layers of mind reading involved in judging whether a group is promoting an ideology that aims to intentionally create a permissive environment for others to damage democracy or freedom. Now it'll be up to ministers and not a court to decide whether a group is promoting an ideology that has any of these aims. That means it will be ministers with all their political interests deciding how to interpret each of these terms. Gove's department has said it will publish a list of organisations it considers extremist in the coming weeks. But in Parliament, Gove went ahead and named a few groups that he thought would be candidates. He mentioned two neo-Nazi groups, the British National Socialist Movement and Patriotic Alternative, before moving on to Muslim groups.
It is important, just as with our definition of extremism, to be precise in the use of language when discussing Islamism. Islamism should never be confused with Islam. Islam is a great faith, a religion of peace, which provides spiritual nourishment to millions, inspires countless acts of charity, and celebrates virtues of generosity, compassion, and kindness. Islamism is a totalitarian ideology which seeks to divide, calls for the establishment of an Islamic state governed by Sharia law, and seeks the overthrow of liberal democratic principles. It has its roots in the thinking of the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, Hassan al-Banna, the founder of Jamaat-e-Islami, Abu al-Maududi, and the Muslim Brotherhood ideologue, Saeed Qutb. The Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood is, of course, Hamas. Organizations such as the Muslim Association of Britain, which is the British affiliate of the Muslim Brotherhood, and other groups such as CAGE and MEND, give rise to concern for their Islamist orientation and views. We will be holding these and other organizations to account to assess if they meet our definition of extremism.
So, you're calling these organizations out as extremist in the House of Commons before you even assess them against the new definition. One of the organisations named in Parliament is MEND, Muslim Engagement and Development, which describes itself as an anti-Islamophobia organisation. Its CEO, Azhar Khayyam, gave LBC his views on that list.
The problem is that we've got Mr. Gove in the Department of Levelling, who is going to decide which organisations are that he puts on this list. Now, I could make a really good argument for putting Mr. Gove on this list for his associations with Henry Jackson Society and Policy Exchange, think tanks that have had far-right American links with organizations like Gatestone and others, with organizations that pummel the Great Replacement Theory. So I could easily make an argument for putting Mr. Gove on a list like this. Now, the problem is I'm not the one who's in charge of the list. Mr. Gove is.
Also named by Gove was CAGE International. Now, CAGE is a group that uncovers abuses of law taking place under counter-terrorism strategies, along with various other groups, including Sisters Uncut, Black Lives Matter, and Palestine Youth Movement. CAGE has released this joint statement. Gove's announcement is a continuation of the decades-long strategy aimed at inciting and exploiting fears against Muslims to build an authoritarian and repressive infrastructure that suppresses any dissent that is not licensed by Whitehall. We, the undersigned, reject the rationale of counter-extremism policy in Britain that serves only to strengthen the state's coercive powers without any pretense of due process or judicial oversight. We will continue to engage in political activity, protest, and direct action for the public good, outside of the narrow constraints of licensed dissenters, which this new definition will seek to impose. We note that defining extremism has been a failed endeavour despite multiple prime ministers and 7 years of the CCE, and nearly two decades since Prevent was brought in. Meanwhile, the Muslim Association of Britain have issued this challenge to Gove. If Gove is confident in his views about the Muslim Association of Britain and other organisations alleging extremist views and a threat to UK society, we challenge him to state them outside Parliament. However, due to the fear of legal challenges, we know he lacks the courage to do so. The association is referencing Gove's parliamentary privilege there. In Parliament, he can say whatever the hell he likes without the threat of legal action. Outside of Parliament, it's a different story. Being labelled as extremist by the government will be a pretty big deal for any group. Sure, it won't have criminal consequences, but it will likely tarnish their reputation in a way that will affect everything from fundraising to the ability to access banking. And if a group is labelled as extremist, there won't be much they can do about it, because a labelled group will be able to ask for a review of the status but by submitting new evidence, but there's no formal appeal avenue of appeal. That means that only recourse will be judicial review by the courts, which is a very long and very expensive process. Gove's announcement has the support of the Prime Minister.
There has been a rise in extremist activity that is stirring division, undermining our values and liberal parliamentary democracy. That's not right, and it's important that government has the tools that it needs to protect us against that. That's what the strategy will outline.
The plan also has the qualified backing of Labour leader Keir Starmer.
Do we need to review the situation? Yes, we do. Are there new threats? Yes, there are. But what's most important is that this is truly cross-party. This will be the test of the government. Are they really reaching out to other parties to make something, this is something which can go forward as a matter of consensus? Or are they going to try and use this sort of for party political process, point scoring as we go into the election?
I think we already know the answer to that, Keir. Now, earlier today, I spoke to Akiko Hart, director of the human rights watchdog Liberty. I started by asking her what the issues with this new redefinition are.
First of all, it's deeply cynical. It's coming at a time of national tension and it's being pushed out for political gain. It's pretending to be defending democracy and it's profoundly anti-democratic. And if we look at the wider context here, it's also coming amidst increasing crackdown on protests through different pieces of legislation and like the ramping up of rhetoric around the marches. So that is the wider context it's coming in, and it's deeply cynical because of that. But fundamentally, the definition is unworkable. And it's unworkable because it's an incredibly broad definition. It's actually very, very difficult to define nonviolence extremism, as this definition proves. And what it will do is that we'll end up including a lot of organizations and groups and individuals it currently has no intention of including. And that's why so many people from counterterrorism experts to home secretaries like Priti Patel have spoken up against it.
When we say this definition or this redefinition is unworkable and that it will end up pulling in groups that it has no intention to do so, do we mean that in a good faith way? Because we've already seen Michael Gove name check Muslim advocacy organizations. So are we saying, oh, you know, it will pull in groups like that, which clearly Gove is trying to target unfairly? Or do we mean that even more groups are going to be pulled into this redefinition?
That's a really good point. So essentially, this is a bad faith definition. Clearly, what Michael Gove is trying to do here is mainly target Muslim and pro-Palestinian organizations. And we can see that from the list that came out today. But you can't define nonviolence extremism in that way. And so the definition has to be broad. And so what we'll see is more and more groups being pulled in.
At this point, are there plans or ways to challenge this redefinition? Or will it rest upon whether groups like MEND or the Muslim Association of Britain are named, and then the challenges will start?
This definition is non-statutory. So that means it's not legislation, it's guidance. And actually, we wouldn't be seeing this if this was legislation, because it wouldn't meet the mark of a legal definition. So that's why it's guidance. And so essentially, it's effective immediately and replaces the previous definition of nonviolence extremism that we saw in Prevent that was set up in 2011. So one of the many, many issues with this particular definition and the processes around it is that groups which are named have little to no recourse to justice around being named. So there's no appeals process, for example. You're blacklisted and that's it. And the only recourse you have is what gets called judicial review, which is an incredibly long, expensive, time-consuming process through the courts. Now, my understanding is that some of the groups which are named are potentially looking at this at the moment. And I think they would probably have a very good case because given how this has come about, given which groups have been named, there's clearly a really, really strong discrimination angle. There's also been little to no consultation around it. So again, that kind of like doesn't meet the threshold in terms of this kind of practice. So I think there's a strong case, but it will take something like a judicial review rather than a normal appeals process to be able to appeal it.
It seems to me that there has been an increase of the government using guidance as a tactic to crack down on civil liberties. What would you say about that?
I think we're seeing both. So I think we've seen two big pieces of legislation, the Policing Act and then the Public Order Act, which have cracked down on protest. And we're likely to see some amendments to the Criminal Justice Bill that I think are coming out next week or the week after, that were trailed a couple of weeks ago. So around criminalising climbing war memorials and criminalising the use of face masks in protests. So we are seeing a lot of legislation around protests. But you are right as well, is that we are also seeing guidance. And I think that worries me intensely, because essentially the scrutiny for guidance is much lower. So it obviously doesn't go through Parliament in the same way. It gets less attention. The bar is lower in every way. But what you end up with is a chilling effect, because these groups which are blacklisted, which will be essentially blacklisted, they won't get government funding. and they won't be invited to engage with government. That's one thing, but that means that other kind of arm's length bodies, like, for example, universities, might feel under intense pressure not to, for example, engage with those groups or platform those groups. And so we will see a chilling effect through this guidance.
Is this a new tactic, or is this something that we've seen in the past around prescribing groups on cracking down on civil liberties?
Yeah, I think it's very much something that we've seen in the past, and it very much fits into the Prevent playbook, which it deals with that kind of essentially pre-crime area. So, because current legislation around hate crime and terrorism deal with actions, the bar is much higher. But essentially what Prevent is trying to do is it's looking at kind of thoughts and behaviours in, you know, what MEDAC call that pre-criminal space. And it's essentially targeting, in particular children and young adults, in school or kind of health settings, and putting them under intense scrutiny. And actually what's very interesting about Prevent is that both its critics and its proponents say that it's failed. So yes, we have seen this this use of guidance, which kind of falls under the radar, but has hugely nefarious effects on a day-to-day basis, in particular for, marginalised and racialised communities.
Will this renewed hijacking of the word extremism and the definition of extremism in order to crack down on groups the government finds distasteful outlast a Tory government? Have Labour's shown any signs of wanting to pick this up?
I think there are many voices within the Labour Party. So, for example, we saw Sadiq Khan today really push back on this definition and really highlight some of the dangers. So there is some hope. But I haven't seen as much, as I would have liked. So, for example, extremism can relate to political extremism as well as faith-based extremism. And within the faith, it can relate to all or any of the faiths, for example, Christian extremism or, Hindu extremism or Jewish extremism. And yes, in this country, extremism is used as a shorthand for Muslim extremism. And what I would like to see, Labour do is push back really, really strongly on that association. And we haven't really seen that yet from the leadership.
That was Akiko Hartz from Liberty speaking to me earlier today. Now, Gove's new extremism announcement comes at a time when the Conservative Party is under scrutiny for what many would call extremism in its own ranks. Its biggest donor, Frank Hester, who gave the party at least £10 million in the last year, is reported to have actually called for a serving MP to be shot. On BBC Breakfast, the racist remarks Hester is alleged to have made and hasn't denied about Diane Abbott were put to Gove.
When Frank Hester allegedly said that, and I want to get this quote right, "I don't hate all black women at all, but I think she should be shot." Is that an extremist view?
Well, speaking as someone who was pursued by an individual who was trying to kill me and who subsequently succeeded in killing one of my friends in Parliament, I take that sort of language very seriously, and I think it's unacceptable.
I'm sorry, that's not quite what I asked. Is that an extremist view, and would it fall under these new rules, these new definitions of extremism? I can repeat the quote for you if you wish again.
Well, I take these things exceptionally seriously, and because I take them seriously, it would be the case that any assessment about whether or not an individual or an organisation is extremist would have to follow a rigorous process. It wouldn't be me making a decision on the basis of a quote, however horrific. It would be a due diligence process that would be conducted very carefully.
Such a rigorous process that allowed him to read out the names of three advocacy groups in Parliament with apparently no evidence of their extremism and was done simply on the basis that they happen to be Muslim advocacy groups. But no personal beefs involved in any of this pursuit of a redefinition of extremism. Over on Good Morning Britain, Susanna Reid had another go at getting Gove to talk.
When somebody says something about hatred and violence, which leaves the MP, who was the target of those comments, saying that she is frightened, she feels vulnerable, she's worried and refers to the fact that two MPs have been murdered in recent years, and that this sort of talk is alarming, that presumably does come under your definition of extremism.
Well, it, as I say, the first thing is that I'm an admirer of Diana. I think that her work throughout her career, particularly in advancing the cause of better education for children from disadvantaged backgrounds, is wonderful. She should never be subject to language of this kind. And it is a recorded fact that Diane, like many women in public life and many women of colour, has received and been on the receiving end of the most objectionable and horrific language and threats, and for the reasons that we were just discussing. Threats against members of parliament and people in public life are something I know about and take incredibly seriously. It's because of that that government has a responsibility not just to call out racism, but also to work with organizations that are promoting unity, social cohesion, a greater degree of tolerance and understanding. And my job as a government minister is to work with those organizations and individuals on the ground who are attempting to bring communities together, who are attempting to counter anti-Semitism, attempting to fight anti-Muslim hatred, and attempting also to deal with racist prejudice of whatever kind.
The extreme opinions of another Tory donor, GB News founder Paul Marshall, were also raised with Gove in Parliament.
This tweet was liked by Sir Paul Marshall. Civil war is coming. There has never been a country that has remained peaceful with a sizable Islamic presence. Once the Muslims get to 15 to 20% of the population, the current cold civil war will turn hot. Many other incendiary tweets were liked or retweeted by Marshall, a substantial donor to both the Tory party and the Secretary of State personally, according to a recent Hope Not Hate newsagent's investigation. How does the Secretary of State square his definition of extremism with accepting money from someone like Marshall?
Well, I deprecate the personal attack on Sir Paul Marshall, who is a distinguished philanthropist and the supporter of ARC academies, which are state schools that have done so much, including in the Honourable Gentleman's constituency, to improve the lives of disadvantaged children from a variety of minority backgrounds.
Gove has previously described himself also as a, quote, proud Zionist, and on LBC he was confronted by his own rather extreme views on Palestine. In his 2006 book, Celsius 77, Michael Gove said that, quote, appeasement of the Palestinians by the Oslo Accords encouraged Al-Qaeda to commit 9/11. The Oslo Accords were a pair of agreements signed in the 1990s between Israel and Palestine, intended to begin the process of re-establishing a Palestinian state. So it's not hard to read Gove's remark as suggesting that Palestinians should never have been offered a state. On LBC, he was asked where he now stood on the issue.
Do you still believe that the Oslo Accords were appeasement?
I, again, believe that it's vital that we bring people together at a time of division in order to ensure...
That's lovely, but do you still agree with yourself that the Oslo Accords were appeasement?
Well, I think it's critically important that all of us recognise the need for moves towards a sustainable ceasefire in the Middle East. And again, foreign policy, like security policy, moves on to take account of new realities. It's vitally important that we ensure that the threat to Israel from Hamas is dealt with. It's also vitally important that we ensure that a path towards a secure and viable state,
with a two-state solution,
a democratic home for the Palestinian people is secured as well.
And you agree with a two-state solution?
Oh, of course, yes, absolutely.
So Gove there saying his views have changed as realities on the ground have changed. But just a moment later, Gove seemed unwilling to even acknowledge those realities.
The UK law recognises Gaza is occupied. Is UK law wrong?
No, I think UK law is right. But I think it's important also when we're dealing with these inevitably sensitive questions, to recognise that the...
So Gaza is occupied by Israel?
Well, at the moment, it is the case that there is a terrible conflict going on there that followed on from the slaughter of...
What it is the British government thinks about what is going on in Gaza. Gaza is occupied by Israel, isn't it?
Well, at the moment, an horrific conflict is going on there. Israel, understandably, wants to ensure that Hamas no longer poses a threat after the events of October the 7th. But it is also the case that we need to ensure that the Palestinian people get the aid that they need.
Does Michael Gove recognise that Gaza is occupied by Israel?
Well, I recognise the vital importance of the British government speaking with one voice on foreign policy. We have an excellent foreign secretary in David Cameron, and I support everything that he says and does.
It's not quite a yes. Okay. What is going
to... It is a yes.
It is a yes. Good.
But? No. No buts. It is a yes.
Sound like there's a but to me. Helena, my question is, how do we on the ground cope as the government gets more extreme, becomes more draconian, yet keeps trying to convince us that the problem is with peaceful protesters?
The natural reaction is that we should be fearful of the government engaging in incredibly draconian, as you say, legislation and changes to definitions, essentially centralising power in a very small number of individuals to be able to define what is and is not extremist, use this for political point storing and demonise an entire movement that we belong to. This is something that we're fearful of. But it's also worth noting that this is desperate moves from the government. And governments only do desperate things when they are also fearful. And what they are fearful of is the fact that we're winning. Right? We're winning the argument on this one. All of the smears, the discussions of hate marches and trying to smear all of the pro-Palestinian movement as being Islamist or whatever, which is, to be fair, which is what this all is. This is all in response to the pro-Palestinian movement. They think they can get an electoral advantage and they're not going to get it. They're going to get wiped out the next election based upon current polling anyway. It's not doing them any favours. And on top of that, none of these smears are actually coming through when the public get polled about these issues. All of these different changes to how they operate in government, they can't stop us from seeing the images coming through on our phones. They can't stop the general public hearing and seeing what's happening in the Palestinian territories at the moment. And when it comes to what the public think about issues of Palestine and Israel, they overwhelmingly agree with us on these issues. A supermajority of the general public have wanted a ceasefire for months, have supported one. A plurality of people in this country believe that, she was also a supermajority, sorry, of people in this country believe that Israel has committed war crimes throughout this most recent conflict. A plurality of people in this country, when polled by YouGov, have said that they believe that the military intervention of Israel was unjustified. And of course, there is widespread government disapproval from the public on the issue of Israel and Palestine as well, and of course more broadly too. So whilst, you know, we still need to organise, that doesn't mean that anything can stop. We have to continue organising. If they smear or they try and get rid of one particular group by labelling them as extremists, then we can always find more and better ways of organising around what the government do. That's what the left have done, despite plenty of opportunities that government have had to try and demonise and try and marginalise the left. We've always managed to find a way of organising around it. I always have the trust in our movement to be able to do that. But in terms of the actual discussion of this issue and the public opinion, we're winning people over and the government cannot stop us from being able to continue to do that.
Let's go on to our next story. Diane Abbott has finally had her say on the racist scandal that has engulfed parliamentary politics this week. Abbott tried to speak up yesterday during Prime Minister's questions, but she was denied by Commons Speaker Lindsay Hoyle. Now, he's been widely criticised for ignoring Abbott's 46 attempts to ask a question when MPs were discussing the racist, misogynistic comments of top Tory donor Frank Hester, which, of course, were directed at Diane Abbott. So Hoyle's decision was especially egregious, given that Hester called for Abbott to be shot. And MP safety is an issue Hoyle says he cares about so much that he previously broke parliamentary precedent for it. Now, Abbott has published two different comment pieces in The Independent and The Guardian. The top lines, well, Abbott highlights the gap between the Tory rhetoric on, quote, extremism and the party's unwillingness to confront the extreme language of its politicians and donors. But she doesn't spare the Labour Party either. She cites the 2022 Ford report, which uncovered racism within the Labour Party, including abuse directed at Abbott from senior party officials. She notes that, to this day, none of the individuals concerned have apologised to me, and the Labour Party has not apologised to me personally. Abbott also discussed her own suspension from the Labour Party, which came after she suggested that Jewish, Irish and traveller people had only been subject to prejudice and not racism. Abbott wrote, As the general election draws near, it will be important for the Labour Party to step up to challenge racism, even if it costs us a few points in the polls. Starmer did refer to me in Prime Minister's questions, but all the indications are that the people around him are digging in against any suggestion that I should have the whip restored. It will be both sad and strange if Starmer throws Britain's first black woman MP out of the PLP because of an 8-line letter for which I immediately apologised. But the most important thing is that the Labour Party holds fast to its anti-racist tradition. On Jeremy Vine's BBC Radio 2 show this morning, Starmer was asked about whether he'd restored the whip to Abbott.
There's a conversation which has gone on Twitter, which Diane Abbott says is true, where you approached her after the House of Commons hoo-ha yesterday. You said, "Diane, let me know if there's anything I can do." She says, "You could restore the whip." And you say, "I understand, just let me know if there's anything." She says, "Restore the whip." You say, "I understand."
Yeah, I mean, let me deal with that head on, because I obviously went over to, I reached out to Diane on the day before PMQs, but obviously seeing that she was in the chamber, my first instinct when the questions finished was to go up and talk to her in person. And of course, there's the issue of the whip, but that's for an entirely different issue. That was about allegations of anti-Semitism in relation to a letter, as you've just referred to, which is subject to an ongoing investigation, which is separate from me. That's not something which I conduct. That's an independent process.
But she has apologised for it.
Well, yes, but it's not resolved. But I take the thrust of your point, which is we must support Diane Abbott in this. Particularly, I mean, she was a trailblazer, by the way. She's
That's my point. I mean, if in some countries there'd be a statue of her, and yet she may not be able to fight her seat in the next election if you don't hurry up and resolve this.
Yeah, all I'm saying is the abhorrent language used by the Tory donor about Diane Abbott is abhorrent, needs to be called out, the money needs to be returned. That's one thing. There is a separate issue, which is Diane's own language, which is subject to a different procedure. Don't think we can just conflate the two at this stage.
His deputy, Angela Rayner, told reporters a similar story, except she said she wanted to see Abbott back in the Labour Party. According to the BBC, Rayner said this: "Personally, I would like to see Diane back, but the Labour Party has to follow its procedures. So it doesn't matter what I think, because I don't make that decision, because it is done through a panel and it has gone through experts. I'm not involved in that process." Well, that process is dragging. Last year, Labour restored the whip to Neil Coyle after he was suspended for racially abusing reporter Henry Dyer. Rupert Huck also had the Labour whip restored after a 5-month investigation into racist comments she made about former Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng. It's now nearly a year since Abbott was stripped of the whip, and there's a bit of confusion about exactly what the process of the investigation to Abbott entails. Because Keir Starmer keeps saying it's an independent process, keeps saying Angela Rayner has said this too. But Andrew Fisher, a reporter, says that MPs, Labour MPs, have been told it's actually being investigated by the chief whip. So isn't a part of an independent process? Are MPs being misled? Is the media being misled? Meanwhile, Andrew Fisher and Lee Harpin have also, another journalist, has also reported that there is a deal on the table with Diane Abbott where the Labour leadership say that she can have the whip back if she stands down at the next general election. Now, Labour have not commented on these allegations yet, but it's certain that this story is not going to go away. Meanwhile, on the other side of the aisle, the Tories continue to try and explain why violent racist language isn't actually violent or racist, and that they should be allowed to be funded by people who hold such views. This was Michael Gove defending Frank Hester on Sky.
Can someone really apologise for a racist comment, which is what the Prime Minister thinks these comments were, without acknowledging that the comments were racist?
Well, again, I haven't spoken to Mr. Hester, but I think that when someone says that they are sorry, and I understand he's deeply sorry for these remarks, then my natural inclination is to exercise Christian forgiveness.
Christian forgiveness for Frank Hester, who hasn't denied that he called for the murder of a sitting MP. But Muslim advocacy groups tackling Islamophobia in Britain need surveilling and blacklisting from political involvement. That's Gove logic. His stance is pretty unsurprising, given that the Eye reports Frank Hester's cash was responsible for 21% of all total Tory donations given to the party last year. Meanwhile, there's apparently more Hester money pending in the Tory accounts. According to an exclusive by Tortoise Media, the Tories are squatting on a further £5 million from Frank Hester. This is thanks to the Electoral Commission donations register only being updated quarterly, which means the donation is currently undocumented. And so far, Rishi Sunak is refusing to return the documented £10 million the party has already received from Hester. If that total is brought to 15, pressure could grow. And not just from outside the Tory ranks. Other Tory donors are even taking action. Businessman Mohamed Amersi has donated nearly £600,000 to the Tories since 2018. But he told journalist Lewis Goodall that he's now holding the chequebook.
Will you be giving any more money to the Conservative Party?
Not for now. I'm holding the chequebook back because there are lots of problems that the CCHQ has to, first of all, sort out before I open my chequebook.
Do you think that the how do you think the Prime Minister has dealt with this over the past few days?
So I think it's been an absolute disgrace. But before that, let me just say one thing. I have lived in this country for a long time. I went to school here, went to university here, had jobs here. I had never, ever saw any form of racism until the Conservative Party and CCHQ. That was my first experience of institutionalized racism. And it's so sad to see the party behave in this way. I think that Rishi fudged the issue. He should have taken it head on in the beginning. We should not have had to wait till Kemi Badenoch to say and call out racism. It was racist. And my deep question is, do the spots on a leopard ever change? Is it enough for somebody to say, even if it's not an apology, that I apologize? Does that really mean that the spots of a leopard have changed? I think that there are fundamental structural issues in the party. I think that the treasurers have overstayed their time in the party. I think they need to resign. I think fresh people have to come. And then I go back to my first point, which is that we need to cap donations. We cannot allow political processes to be hijacked by the richest, and they then call the shots. And here in Washington, I was asking myself, I faced a similar issue, which I still continue to face. Nobody in the party ever came to my rescue. Why? Is it because I'm non-white? Is the attention given to Hester because he's a male white donor? Or is it because of £10 million? Or is it because of his unrivaled access on AI to Rishi Sunak? Or is it because Sunak took a helicopter ride paid by him? I have no idea.
Now, Amersi isn't exactly speaking out just because his conscience has kicked in. This is a man who was very aware of how to buy influence with the Conservatives. In fact, he was actually the subject of a long Guardian expose in February, detailing the grubby manner in which money bought him access and influence within the Tory party. That is until a very public spat with former MP Charlotte Leslie, who raised questions about the source of Amersi's wealth. David Davis then used his parliamentary privilege to publicly accuse Amersi of, quote, bullying in the House of Commons. Since then, Amersi has been very disenchanted with the Tory party and the people who managed to get him in the first place. And it's worth noting, he has been holding the checkbook since he felt personally abandoned and slighted by the Tories. And only during his icing out from access to power did he begin to take note of the racism experienced by those out in the cold. But that's a really key part of this story to me. Because my question is, who feels the biggest impact of the racism present in our political life? Who has their concerns taken seriously versus who is left to battle violent abuse on their own? I hear a lot of talk about hierarchies of racism, but I think it's also really important to look at the political allegiance of racism. Because left-wing MPs of colour and peaceful protesters opposing imperialism and occupation who have large ethnic minority demographics among their number are demonised and abused. But it is those either to the right of them on the political spectrum or useful to that agenda who are afforded, sometimes temporary, protection and assigned vulnerability, which is why a black hard right would-be Tory MP, like Ben Obsidjekty, can go to the police and prosecute other black people for a supposed racist abuse over raccoon emoji. Why he can use that system. Whereas a black left-wing MP, who has served for nearly 40 years in the House of Commons, can be ignored 46 times when she even just tries to speak about the racist abuse directed at her. racist abuse made by a hugely powerful, wealthy man who has so much influence with the current government that they're out here lobbying on news channels for forgiveness on his behalf. And here's an example that stuck with me last week when I was away. Why someone like Mark Gardner, who represents right-wing Jewish organisation, the Community Security Trust, can say on the BBC Today programme that pro-Palestine marches make it unsafe for Jewish people to go into London. But when he's challenged and asked, but what about the Jewish people on those marches? He said, oh, there's only two types of Jews who attend those protests, either, quote, ultra-Orthodox Jews or revolutionary socialists who are, quote, using their Jewishness so people get the impression that this movement is not fundamentally anti-Semitic. Absolutely baseless, groundless accusations. But what he's saying there is those are the wrong types of Jews. He thinks those Jews don't count as Jewish enough to refute his claims. And I bring up these examples to demonstrate how political allegiance impacts who is seen to be at the risk of racist harm, who is protected, and how the right weaponizes, supposedly protecting certain people in order to attack other causes and beliefs. Meanwhile, they're fueling more hatred. Do you think that revolutionary socialists who are Jewish don't suffer from anti-Semitism? But as Mohammed Amersi found out, if you are exiled from usefulness or allegiance, suddenly all that concern and protection falls away very quickly. Let's go on to our next story. Israel continues to plan its ground offensive on the southern Gazan city of Rafah. But the country has come under significant pressure, which means very little pressure, by the US to draw up a credible plan that will ensure the safety of Palestinian civilians. And now it appears that a version of that plan is coming together. The IDF is proposing to move civilians from Rafah to what it is calling humanitarian islands before the ground operation begins. According to a briefing from IDF spokesperson Daniel Hagari, the humanitarian islands will be in areas in the central parts of the Gaza Strip. They will also contain temporary housing, food, water, and other necessities for displaced Palestinians. But no further details of the plan have been revealed, and the logistics seem pretty improbable. There are now more than 1.4 million Gazans in Rafah pressed up against the Egyptian border in the far south. Moving them between 15 and 20 miles to the central zone south of Gaza City could take weeks, and it would mean moving them nearer to several areas where Israeli ground operations are already taking place. And if Palestinians get to central Gaza, well, this is what awaits them. Large areas of the central strip lie in ruins, with buildings blasted out and rubble everywhere. Many roads are impassable, and swathes of infrastructure have been destroyed by Israeli bombs. And not to forget that under that rubble lie thousands of decaying bodies. It is hell. Now, the phrase humanitarian islands, meaning areas separated from one another, which can provide temporary housing and basic necessities, might itself also be a euphemism, because internment camps might be a better phrase. And with the population weakened by hunger, moving huge numbers of people into conditions that are even more cramped than those in Rafah will inevitably lead to outbreaks of disease. UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine, Francesca Albanese, told the BBC what she thought of this plan.
I'd just like to get your thoughts on these humanitarian islands, which have been talked about by Israel. Is there a way in which they could work and protect those displaced Palestinians, more than 1.4 million of them who are in Gaza, in Rafah, in the southern Gaza Strip at the moment?
Hi, Anne. Of course, I'm very concerned about what this might mean, because Israel has been using humanitarian language to cover what is de facto the commissions of crimes in Gaza. Safe zones, evacuation orders, nothing has worked according to international humanitarian law. And I'm all the more worried because I know that the conditions of life in the Gaza Strip are very difficult wherever we look at, because 70% of the civilian infrastructure has been destroyed. So where are these 1.4 million people going to go? Which houses? And there are not even enough tents to host these people. So no, I'm extremely concerned. And I think that the only way to get out of this tragedy is to have a ceasefire. This is the only way to provide a shelter to the millions of survivors of this catastrophe in Gaza.
Albanese is right. The only solution is a permanent ceasefire, and we shouldn't let ourselves be fooled by the language of humanitarianism. As Albanese says, Israel has cloaked its actions in that term from the outset, all while making its dehumanisation of Palestinians very clear. A video released by the IDF shows two men walking with a bicycle in Gaza. According to humanitarian groups, the men were on their way home after trying to collect aid. Then, from nowhere, they're hit by a targeted missile fired from a drone above. So humanitarian. Israel says it mistook the bicycle for an RPG rocket launcher. No checks, no second take, just instant death from the sky. None of the basic humanity that Israel, as an occupying and vastly stronger power, should be extending to the occupied. The Israeli army has now apologised. So that's all right then. That'll bring them back to life. Let's go on to our next story. The comments made about Diane Abbott by a Tory donor have also shone a light on the Labour Party's treatment of her and other minority MPs. Abbott has drawn those connections herself, writing this in The Independent. The Tories are outrageously racist and sexist, Abbott says, but so are Labour. On Politics Live, co-editor of Tribune magazine, Taj Ali, agreed.
Let's remember what the Ford report actually said. It identified a hierarchy of racism within the Labour Party. We have to remember that the vast majority of black people in this country, Muslim people in this country, engage in party politics through the Labour Party. The Muslim Network report from a few years ago found 1 in 3 British Muslims had experienced Islamophobia within the Labour Party. Black female Labour MPs, Dawn Butler and many others, have repeatedly said that Labour Party does not take anti-black racism seriously. And so she's apologised. I think she was wrong to say what she said. But she has apologised. She's very sincere about that. And she should absolutely be readmitted. And I think the Labour Party is not doing anywhere near enough to tackle this disgusting racism and this disrespect that Diane Abbott was subjected to. Let's remember what the report said. It said that Diane Abbott was found crying in the loos and you had senior Labour officials taking the mickey out of her. I mean, that's completely unacceptable. She's going back to work the next day and she's working with these people. It's a joke.
Labour actually are trying to have their cake and eat it by, you know, Keir Starmer saying, OK, well, we feel so bad about Diane and what the Tories are doing is terrible. Labour even used the row to try and boost their own funding. They sent a letter out to Labour Party supporters saying that the Tory party's biggest donor, Frank Hester, has been exposed for making racist comments. We are fuming. 10 million in their election fund from this man. They're not giving it back. We need to cancel it out. Unlike the Tories, our campaigns rely on small donations from thousands of working people. This is all in aid of a woman they refuse to give the whip back to, even though she has said, the one thing you could do to protect me is give me back the whip. Ditto, the idea that Labour now relies on small donations from thousands of working people when Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves have deliberately moved the funding model so that private donors make up the majority of donations even more than trade unions. It's just bollocks. Sorry, it's just bollocks. So no, Labour are not doing anything to support her really materially. They're speaking about it. They're using it for their own benefit, but they're not actually taking the action that would materially support Diane Abbott. Now, also on the Politics Live panel was Ruth Smith, the former Labour MP who lost her seat to Jonathan Gullis in the 2019 election. Now, this was her response to Taj Ali.
The Ford report has been implemented. The recommendations of the Ford report have been implemented. I am not going to comment on the current, nor should I comment on the current investigation.
No, but what about just generally the treatment? Diane Abbott says she hasn't received an apology for some of the things that Taj has said. Are there issues that need answering, even if you might agree with Claire that that headline is over the top?
I think that there has been a huge change in what the Labour Party was from then to now. We're talking about different leadership, different staff, different everything since that point. Keir Starmer wasn't leader of the Labour Party. And as you know, my own experiences of the Labour Party at that time weren't exactly brilliant.
No. Well, that's obviously, as you say, that was under Jeremy Corbyn's...
This was under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. I mean, I think that's the thing that everyone needs to remember. What came out and those text messages was under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership.
Yeah, it was under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, sent by the people who were trying to kick him out. Those messages, those racist messages, were sent by the people who were trying to undermine him to the point they said they wanted him to lose the election. And they were said about one of his closest political allies and friends. Is Smith trying to suggest that Corbyn is responsible for those messages? Of course, she was a huge anti-Corbyn figure herself at that time. Next up to chat was unaffiliated peer Claire Fox, who wanted to talk about the language of racism rather than racism itself.
I even want to say to you about Islamophobia. You know, you keep saying that word. I mean, Anti-Muslim hatred is very different to Islamophobia, which I want the freedom to criticise Islam, to make fun of it.
Have I on this programme said you're not allowed to criticise my religion? I'm talking about violence and abuse directed to Jewish Muslims. This isn't about terminology. You can criticise religion as much as you like.
I know, good. However, the definitions of Islamophobia would not allow that. And there is a concern that you will bring in blasphemy by the back door. There is my concern. I know, but I should be able to say that. I also think that there is a danger that every time you're talking about one thing, you end up having another racism to contend with. And I do think that does create a competitiveness. And as I've suggested, Diane Abbott was reflecting at that time, it was fashionable to say, and the Jews don't really count in that competitive racism question.
All right.
And that's become fashionable again today, and it's a problem.
Just briefly, in response to what Ruth said, is it better under Keir Starmer's leadership?
Absolutely not. I mean, I myself have experienced Islamophobia within the Labour Party, and British Muslims have repeatedly told me about their own experiences. And so, no, I don't think it's better under Keir Starmer. I think he takes British Muslims for granted.
All right.
I think he does not take seriously racism against black people.
Sorry, I just sat and watched Claire Fox say, I want to do Islamophobia so I can make fun of Islam. And sit there and argue that point to a young Muslim editor who, to Taj's credit, just took that so well, just stayed very calm. He let her speak. And then he said something, you know, comprehensive to Jo Corbyn. And she's like, Jo Corbyn. Her name's not even Jo Corbyn. To the host. And she was just like, all right. There's just no curiosity, no engagement at all with the meat of the matter. And we have these discussions again and again and again on these shows. Now, I've been in them. We go on them and we get asked about these individual incidents all the time. And then when we say, well, it's part of the systemic pattern of dismissal and obstructiveness and disingenuity when it comes to talking about racism and its function. And they're just like, well, is it though? They don't care. They do not care fundamentally about making a change. They care about making content.
It was quite galling to hear Taj specifically say, no, the racism issue is not better under Keir Starmer, especially for people from black minority ethnic backgrounds. And to hear the host just instantly laugh when someone says that Keir Starmer might not be the perfect coronated PM that he seems to be in terms of our media, how there seems to be scant criticism of Keir Starmer's leadership so far. And hearing somebody outside of that tiny little media bubble talk about racism and the hierarchy of racism within Labour can elicit that kind of reaction. What I will say, though, it is nice that we seem to have stopped this Ford Report media blackout in which we don't ever seem to discuss it, or at least we only ever discuss it in very kind of scant terms when it was allowed, and with Taj on the programme, to be able to very specifically talk about the failures of Labour to actually implement the things that were stated within the report. This was also brought up by Apsana Begum on Newsnight last night in an interview with Victoria Derbyshire. Good, actually. It wasn't like a debate format. She was just invited on to talk about her own experiences, which I think are a really important microcosm of the problems that we've seen here. This is a woman who has had to undergo huge amounts of new personal abuse, who, whilst had to take time off for her own mental health reasons from the Labour Party, whilst also having to face a trigger ballot within her constituency at that same time, and has had, in her own words, no support from the top of the Labour Party throughout this entire process. If somebody can be a very explicit example of the failure of this current Labour leadership to actually take these instances of Islamophobic and anti-black racism seriously, then she is one of the most highlightable cases alongside the long-scale street treatment of Diane Abbott that we've seen and was uncovered in the Chakrabarti report and the Ford report so far, and as Taj mentioned in the clip that we saw. It is also quite galling to hear the people who are being criticised then kind of use this as a way to try and soften their own image by trying not talk about the Ford report in the way that it was actually brought to us, by saying, well, actually, we've implemented all the things in the Ford report. So that just shows, actually, you know, we take all the racism things seriously. The big racist party that we had under Labour from 2015 to 2019, when the actual criticisms that we're seeing that haven't properly been implemented from the Ford report were the ones to do specifically with the issue of anti-Black and Islamophobic racism. Martin Ford KC himself is on record, as we saw in his interview with Al Jazeera during the Labour files, as saying he believes that there has not been a sufficient response over the issues of the hierarchy of racism that he explicitly detailed within his own report. And he has not even been contacted after that report by anybody from the top of Labour at the time in which the Al Jazeera episode featuring him was recorded. So for them to just kind of brush off these criticisms, everybody on the panel essentially, including the host, to brush off these criticisms just shows you how the hierarchy of racism is not just specific to the Labour Party, it's within our entire political and media class and is kind of a given at this point.
I'm so tired. I say this a lot across other things, and I think it's because a lot of people are exhausted. But when you look at the impact that having to constantly engage in these discussions and mentally engage with responding to these incidents, which happen again and again and again, and what it does to people of colour in public life, and specifically here, I'm going to talk about Black women. I'm a light-skinned Black woman, so the impact it has on me is much lesser than I see it have on my dark-skinned colleagues. There's two sides to this, in which you see racism function to prevent people like Black women being able to engage in political life in the same way as other demographics are, whether that's, you know, becoming voices in the media or becoming politicians, etc. But there's the other side to it, where people start self-selecting because of how wearing it is to see the constant attacks and abuse, and I'll use the word gaslighting, that someone like Diana Abbott or Kate Osamar has to endure just for the crime of being progressive and being Black in public life. Because there is more protection afforded to ethnic minorities who are willing to uphold the status quo, which is the racist hierarchies that we live in. And I'll use an example that I shared on social media earlier, which is I have had a friend who, you know, while this is all going on, what producers do, they call us all up. They find every brown person in the phone. They say, hey, can you come on the show and talk about Diane Abbott? And a very big political program called me up and said, can you come on and talk about Diane? And I said, look, okay, I actually think you should pick someone else for this, who was close to the story. And what I meant by that was a dark-skinned Black woman who can speak to this story directly. And I asked a friend, would they be willing to do it? And she said, no, because I don't want monkey emojis in her comments. And she'd actually locked her Twitter that day because she tweeted something about the incident and she'd been hit with a load of racist abuse by all the people on social media. Now make lists of Black women and Black people in public life just so they can come and comment on them when they say something that's to do with issues of race. And I'll tell you how that story ended. The political program that had called me up, I found out today that the person they booked in, who was a dark-skinned Black woman and a journalist, they told her they didn't have time to speak to her when it came to her slot. That's all. Thank you, Helena, for joining me tonight.
Always welcome to be sharing the stage with you today, Moya. Much appreciated. Look forward to next time.
And thanks so much to all of you for tuning in. Make sure to come back for tomorrow's stream. You have, as always, loyally, and it's with gratitude that we watch you do it. You've been with Novara Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Novara Media. Go to novaramedia.com/support.